I actually count it as such a huge privilege to do the task that was given to me by Claire, who I absolutely adore, and this is my part of my tribute to finishing what we'd started, and her asking me to share about what I'm so passionate about. I'm really passionate about healing trauma, and you know, anyone who's worked with me knows you shouldn't probably ask me a question about it because I probably won't stop. And I've really enjoyed the journey that I've been on and growing as a therapist. And like Elise has said, you know, at any time you can hop up and go for a wander, because my role is not to trigger anyone, but I'm also quite aware that life happens, and what I think is not going to touch on a sore spot may in fact do that. So before we begin, I just want to run through a couple of things that you might be able to do to help keep that stuff in check for you. One of those things you might be familiar with is grounding. Anyone heard of grounding? I know we've got a room full of therapists. So one of the things you can do while sitting here, no one may not even notice, is you can just look around the room and go, there's the clock, notice objects. Okay, that just kind of brings you back into the here and now. You can do some tapping either with your feet or on your thighs as you're sitting. The other one which I really love doing with people and I do often is thinking about a container in our heads. Okay? So I want everyone to have a go at this. I won't know if you're doing it or not, but I want you to imagine the strongest container in the world. Okay? It's something that's got a reasonable storage space. It locks and it's openable only by you. So really strong, and it depends on your history and your background, what you might be thinking of. I've had tradesmen go, I'm going to build it because I know if I build it, no one's getting in. I had a farmer once who said, I'm getting a silo because I know if you fall in one of them, you ain't never getting out. If you're into Harry Potter or fantasy things, you might have something more magical, mystery kind of thing, treasure chest, that sort of thing. Now, once you've picked it, what you need to do is add the detail. Okay, not just thinking of a concept, but I want you to think of the actual object, the colour, the materials, how big it is, how it locks. So we got a dial on our safe, we got push button codes, we got a padlock on our shipping container, are we going to add some extra chains around it? We can have as many chains as we want, as many padlocks as we want, any kind of key. And that is there to perform the function of pushing things out of the way, locking them down, shutting them off and giving us a bit of distance when we just don't have the time or space to hold that painful thing. So at any point, I may say something that for me is kind of surface level and I think this isn't necessarily going to touch on anything for anyone, but like I said, these things can happen. If you notice it, just go to your container. I want you to picture yourself walking up to it, got my key, putting it in, opening it up, doing all the things you've got to do to open it. Throw that picture, that image, that feeling, that thought in, slam the door, lock it up again and walk away. And then come back to here. And then that's a job for some other day. Last time I spoke was a while ago. And life has got in the way for me and for lots of us for me to follow on from it. I spoke last time about the question explored by Rutger Bregman in his book Humankind about whether people are good. It's not a simple answer, and I'd encourage you, if you haven't already, have a read of the book. It's a lovely book. I really enjoyed it. Bregman doesn't diminish the very real struggles that many of us face in life while offering some incredible insights into the human condition. In my experience, life is actually often very painful. It's unfair and it's unpredictable. On top of the terrible things that just happen, we also have to contend with other people doing things to us that are hurtful. Bregman's conclusion is that, yes, on the whole, people are good, or at least trying to be. I think as Christians, we resonate with this knowledge. We are created good in God's image. And, well, between that and what we're dealing with now, something gets lost along the way. I'm not here to necessarily debate the theology of exactly what goes wrong, why, how that works, and what that means for us at the end of our lives. The older I get, the less certain I become of absolute truths. I am certain that God loves me. He created me, and I'm good. I do make mistakes, a lot. I have a lot to learn. I've often learnt from my mistakes, and then I find myself repeating them over and over again. What I am going to share is my psychological understanding of some of those things, because sometimes a greater understanding of our fellow humans enables us to have more compassion, both on ourselves and on others. I'm also going to share how I connect my psychological understanding of the work I do with people with my faith. At the conclusion of his book, Bregman left us with a list of suggestions or lessons to live by, which are important to repeat and are also a good place to begin. Among them were that we should be assuming the best in others, to look for solutions where everyone wins, to ask more questions, seek to understand other people and their motivations, even if you don't agree with them, and don't be ashamed to do good. These are all excellent ideas. I'm often doing what in our therapist world is called psychoeducation, which basically means I explain stuff. When people understand better how they think and feel and behave and why, it becomes slightly easier to make a change. I spent many years as a social worker, however, explaining stuff to people, coming up with really good suggestions for change, and watching them nod furiously, but not being able to pull any of the change off when they really needed it. I've been working at the health department for more than 10 years, and when I started, I worked at King Edward in our maternity hospital. We had some fantastic processes. Bring multiple departments together to get women out of unsafe situations. And then they'd go back. I did lose patients, both mothers and babies, in my 3 years at the hospital. And I really wanted to understand how strong emotions seem to have the ability to impact so deeply on people's behaviour. In a way that seemed to override the common sense of our own thoughts and our thinking brain. Almost like our thinking brain was being turned off in times of strong emotions and we operated on instinct. But that these instincts sometimes led people to do things that were dangerous, hurtful to themselves and their families, sometimes with catastrophic consequences. Change can be really, really hard, and I wanted to know why. Sincerest apologies to all the other therapists in the room if I either oversimplify stuff or say things you already know, and feel free to correct me later. I came to understand how this was operating and how it could be disrupted and reworked through my eye movement desensitization and reprocessing training. It's a weird name that doesn't really capture what it is, but it's the name that it was given when it was developed by Robin Shapiro in the late 80s. So that stuck, and it's known as EMDR for short. Let me first start by telling you in very, very simple terms what happens in your brain when something stressful occurs. On a normal day, we will think things through. We'll take some time to process the events. Hey, that was really good. I love that coffee. I'm going to go back there. That didn't go so well. Was that my fault? Do I need to address something with them? Did I not do something I should have done? Do I need more information? Do I need to fix something? Do I need to adjust what I'm doing? But that's just for the mild things. We also have a kind of safety switch whereby emotions of a certain level will cause a shutdown to occur. If our distress is too much, then our brains do turn our thinking off. We operate more on a primal level, often without conscious thought, and it's that very fairly well understood fight, flight, freeze response. This is actually really adaptive and necessary in lots of situations. For example, if you are being charged by a huge bear, you don't need to spend any time thinking about where it came from. The fact that we don't actually have these bears in Australia, and if we did, it should be hibernating. You just need to run really fast. Phew, you survive that threat or traumatic event, but your brain knows you skipped something. The thinking and the learning, which is so important, wasn't able to be done, and you have effectively created for yourself some unfinished business. An event with something important, the learning, missing. And your brain doesn't want to deny you the opportunity to do the best learning that you can do. So instead of putting these events or memories neatly in long-term storage, which will fade as time goes by, your brain stores these in a completely different place. And here's one analogy for that. It's kind of like they're at the front, or closer to the surface. Or here we've got two different filing cabinets. One, we've had plenty of time to neatly and orderly put things away. And the further ago they occurred, the further back they'll go. The other ones, we've shoved it in quickly. We just want to get away from it. But the bits are sticking out and they're going to get in our way. And thank you, brain. It stores that sensory component, the images, the sounds, the smells, the emotions, and the thoughts about ourselves in relation to that event, like they're stuck with super glue. Because our brain doesn't want us to lose any valuable information. Let me give you an example. If you fall off a ladder while cleaning the gutter, you might have an image of the sky and the ladder as you fell backwards, the bang as it hit the ground and you hit the ground. When you remember it now, you'll have a feeling, might be shame or anger or pain, and these will come together to make you think something bad about yourself. Might be, oh, I'm so stupid. I always make mistakes. Or I can't do anything right. So here's our event, a memory has three main components: the content, the affect, and the meaning. Now, that meaning is usually bad, okay? So, big words, negative cognitions. And they are terrible ways that we think about ourselves and ourselves in relation to others. They're often unconscious and invariably, when linked to traumatic events, where there's strong distressing emotions stuck, they're really hard to shift. This means that people might be operating on a whole lot of unhelpful ways, not because they're bad, but because they're doing the best they can with some wrong information and some overwhelming emotions. It's almost like emotions have a mind of their own. Think back to the ladder example. After the event, I can rationalise it. I'm not stupid. There was a very simple explanation for what happened. Yay. I know that with my calm and thinking brain. I've done lots of things that prove I'm not stupid. However, if that memory is unresolved or unprocessed, it's still hanging around. So if you hear a loud bang again, or when I walk past the ladder in the shed, that memory can be triggered. My brain takes it as an opportunity. Yes, don't forget, we've got that piece of work you haven't done. How about now? The feelings come back because the brain's done such a great job of storing them so perfectly. Exactly like they were when it happened. They haven't faded. And because they haven't faded and the feelings are so intense, we get the same process happening over again. Brain is going to turn off again. I'm going to operate on instinct. And the feelings will tell me their truth, which is that I'm stupid. And that will feel 100% true while I'm overwhelmed with my feelings. I can't access the helpful information from my thinking brain. And people can have this process going on in the background without being fully aware of it. Here's a list of some very common negative cognitions. And we, as therapists, like to group them into groups. So we've got, you know, I'm wrong, or I did something wrong, I have no control, or that somehow I'm not safe. Negative beliefs such as these can be self-perpetuating. I'm actually going to do stuff that keeps playing these out. And they're considered an a priori absolute truth by the people who hold them. And you can't talk people out of them. There are lots more layers involved in understanding the etiology of very specific wrong ideas and ways of coping with them. And I'm just glossing over the surface. There's a really comprehensive explanation involved in schema therapy, but, you know, I had to try and just do one little thing today and not talk forever. Suffice to say, it's important to note that there are differences between very early repetitive trauma, significant attachment disruption, neglect, abuse in early childhood, while a child's brain is still sorting itself out and laying itself down, and a simple, discrete event that happens later in life. Very early trauma can have a lasting impact on an individual's view of themselves, their ability to set limits, trust others, manage emotions and relationships. Because children have some universal needs for connectedness and relationships, for worthiness and self-esteem, autonomy and the ability to make changes in their world, realistic expectations and realistic limits. And when they aren't met, those children can grow up into adults who have some ideas about themselves which are unhelpful. So, how does EMDR work to process trauma? Again, I'm going to be simplifying this. To begin with, we need to find a target. And a target are these, are those moments or pictures from the past that still have strong emotions stuck to them now when you remember them. And I'm just pausing to note this is not an invitation to start digging for your own. Remember the container. Does that make sense? So if your life was like a box of photographs, some events from the past I can look at and go, oh, that was so funny, that was great. Other ones, oh, it rained, that day was ruined, but I feel nothing when I see the picture. I remember it was crap, but I have no response to it now. And there are others, when I look at them, they will have an emotional response within my body in the here and now when I remember then. Okay, so current feeling from a previous event. Those moments don't have to be the worst part of the story either. What you feel now can be very different to what you felt in the past. In our latter example, I might have been very frightened as I fell and in pain as I lay on the ground, and now I remember it, I'm very angry and ashamed. The targets we are most interested in are the ones that are having impact on things now. So whatever brings that person to therapy. If I was having trouble disciplining my children, then my therapist might be interested in those memories with the strongest emotions that somehow connect with the emotions that I'm currently experiencing and those thoughts that I'm struggling with. What's the history in that? In simple terms, the memory, the target memory with the content, affect and meaning, is activated. while a person is sufficiently distracted. This disrupts the shutdown mechanism from occurring and enables the brain to do the processing and learning it so desperately wanted to do. This has the effect of reducing distress right down to zero or close to zero. And then we can install a positive belief in replacement of the negative one. We'll flip it and go, what's the opposite? What would you really like to believe about yourself? Obviously, there's a lot of preparation and there's a lot more detail involved. But for someone with a simple trauma that happened much later in life and they've got good coping strategies, they're safe now, they can manage strong emotions, then this can happen very quickly and efficiently. In lieu of obvious cognitive blockages, one session of preparation, an event could be moved through a standard protocol in 30 to 70 minutes or one session. The key is to get just the right amount of activation into what we call a window of tolerance. And then distraction is given through bilateral stimulation, which is basically crossing between both sides of your body really fast, and the most common is using eye movements. You can also use tapping, vibrating buzzers or sounds. So low brow would be me going like this, expecting someone to follow my fingers. Or more high tech, some people have light bars. The change in the memory is permanent, and you can't go back to it being distressing once it has been cleaned and moved into long-term storage. The past then stays in the past. A common impact on how this memory is remembered is called distancing, which means that it becomes difficult to recall. It becomes less clear. It feels like they're further away from it, or somehow the view from that picture gets blocked. Sometimes finding the most suitable target can take a really long time. Sometimes working out what the block to processing is can be complex. And some people need months or sometimes years before they have the ability to affect tolerance, the ability to feel strong emotions and remain in control. And some people have complex and multiple traumas that even EMDR or schema therapy isn't simple. A person first has to be in safety. You can't process a trauma that hasn't finished. Bilateral stimulation is done in sets of 30 to 40 seconds, where the person sits quietly and simply lets whatever happens happen. They might see pictures in their mind, they might experience emotion, sensation, or think things. Whatever happens is reported at the end of the set, and then I'll provide some guidance as to whether just keep going or we'll check back at our original target. For young people or even older people who've watched Harry Potter, I'll sometimes talk about the Pensieve, you know, the big bowl he puts his face in to look at memories. Anyone? Yeah, so you tip the memory into the liquid, you put your face in the water, and he sees it happen. But he's the only one who sees it happen, so when he lifts his head up, Dumbledore is like, what was it? It's a bit like me. So they're basically very still. No one's talking, not even me. But I need to know what that internal process was. What I'm looking for is some kind of cognitive shift towards a more adaptive idea. I don't know what it'll be, but I've been trained to recognise it when I see it. Processing continues until they report that the distress has gone down to zero or nearly zero, and then we consider the opposite to the original negative cognition and continue processing again until the believability of the positive statement is 100%. That's the reprocessing part. Some people will have the same negative belief across multiple events, which they will consider what they call this is the evidence. I know I'm bad because this, and this happened. Events that get stuck don't have to be horrific either. I often treat childhood bullying, and in women, the most common thing I treat is birth trauma. The most surprising event I've ever processed was by a woman who'd suffered intensely as an adult, who could track the same negative belief that there was something wrong with her back to when she was 4 years of age and her mum had to work on her birthday. Even though the distress was low, because as an adult and a single parent, she was like, if you got to work, you got to work, I get it. She said the image of her young self running down the driveway after her mother's car, hysterical, was clear and vivid 45 years later. So, sidestep. There's a great adjunct to standard EMDR, and I've got a 6-minute video of it in action because it kind of highlights and pulls together some of the things I've been talking about. My trusty assistant is going to pull it up for me. This is called the Flash Technique and it was developed by Philip Manfield in the US. It was designed to bring the distress down to a tolerable level before standard processing, but in some situations can be used instead. I'm going to skip the first 3 minutes because in that it takes her a really long time to learn how to blink and think at the same time. We don't need to see that. So basically he's asking her, do you have a memory that's really high in distress? She says, yep, I got one. And he says, can you think of something really engaging and positive? And she picks one of her kids. And then she just has to sit there. He gives her a couple of other things to do and she has to blink when he says flash. And let's watch.
Flash. Good. And now we're going to do it again. Triple. Flash.
It's hard to do.
Okay. You're doing great.
Okay.
Flash. Were you thinking of the memory at all?
No.
Terrific. And so now think about it.
Okay.
And see if you notice any change.
It's harder to think about. So let me take it. Actually, already I feel a change, yeah.
So, the change is what?
Before when I thought about it, I got like a feeling off, like, blah, blah.
Physical.
Yes, physical. And now I still get the image. I'm still like, well, okay, I still got a little bit of physical. Uh-huh. But it's not as much as it was where I just felt way more physical.
So it was 9 or 10 before. What would you say now?
Like a 4 or 5.
Okay. Good. So let's just do it again.
Okay.
Flash. 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 That's a good one. Flash. Great. Okay. So, again, think of the memory and see if you notice any change.
It's harder to bring up the memory. I'm actually like having to like do some driving. And yeah, it's interesting. It's more of like a cognitive, like that is actually a weird situation. But I don't feel the same amount of ickiness around it. It's kind of more just like, oh, that's weird. So I'm just a little, I guess like a two now.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Good. So let's just do it again.
Do one more. Okay. I feel more compassion around the situation instead of just like, ugh. yeah, that's really nice. I actually feel like I feel like that kind of did it. Can I say what it was or not?
If you want.
Just because it's creepy. I was working at a really ICM, and one of the people who was in the passenger seat that I was driving, I turned around and looked, and they had bed bugs crawling out of their jacket, across. And I was just like, but now, and I don't know, every time I thought of that, I was just like, oh, that's so awful that, I don't know, it was just like, it brought up a lot of stuff, but now it's more like, it just changed the way I look at it. Instead of it seeming like just this horrible thing, it just seemed like, oh, that's kind of sad. But, yeah.
0 to 10.
You think I'm back at a 10?
No, 0 to 10.
Oh, 0 to 10. It's sad. I guess it's like 2. I feel like it's still kind of a sad situation, but I don't feel like grossed out, if that makes sense. Which it is a sad situation, so I think maybe you can't.
That's right. That's a distinction that you make when you're doing EMDR also, which is that sometimes clients get into a position of compassion and they're feeling sad for...
That's right. You can stop it there. Yeah, it's just about finished. So basically she's changed from being quite overwhelmed with how she felt about that situation within herself to feeling compassion for the person. And it's a lovely... illustration of the way that the brain can change. Brains are so both flexible and inflexible when we know how to adjust them. So what has this meant for me, and how do I apply these kind of ideas to my faith? One of the things I've learnt is that it's just not up to me to make a judgment. There's no rules about what's bad enough to get stuck. My work will be successful if I find exactly what the image is that needs processing. It doesn't matter which part of the story feels the most distressing now when someone remembers it. In fact, if I influence someone's choice, then I'm unlikely to be successful. And I don't compare pain. I don't compare someone's trauma or their level of coping. Trauma can hold irrespective of your intelligence, how much work you put into it. If it hurts you, it hurts you, and that gives me something to work on. I don't have to tell people what to think or feel. Processing is unique to every individual. I have no idea what the connection or insight will be that will come up for each person. I don't have to be directive. Rather, I'm there just to guide the process to a successful end, and it is such an honour and a privilege to watch it happen. This allows me to treat each person's individual journey with the utmost respect. A complete session means that I'll keep doing sets of eye movement until my arm is sore. No, until the distress is gone and the positive belief is fully installed. The significance of this has only recently dawned on me. Bearing in mind some kind of cognitive block or something that's got in the way, every person can reach full 100% believability in their positive beliefs. Think about that for a minute. Everyone can believe these things 100%. Why? because these things are true 100% for everyone. I'm trained to administer this protocol and keep going until it's done. I'm not told, look, when you've got someone who's only 50% good and they're just average, we're only after average confidence. This is true for everyone. Not just the objectively good people, but everyone can have these things as the truly held belief about themselves. They don't have to do good stuff to get a confidence in their own goodness. And perhaps it's because we're surrounded by people who do bad things and hurt us and people we care about that we forget that people are actually good, even if they are not being their best selves right now. Let me remind you of this one again. There's no caveat on this statement. It applies to all of us. There is one anomaly to this phenomenon, however. Let's just consider a positive belief, I did the best I could. Can anyone think when that might not be true? What about when you actually... Go, Ken.
When you're angry.
Yep. What might you have done that is... could not be processed to, I did the best I could. I actually did something really bad. Yep. For many years, the vast majority of people I treated were victims in some degree. Something had been done to them. They'd witnessed something. Someone else had spectacularly failed. Something outside of their control occurred. It was definitely someone else's fault, even if initially they felt it was their own. And then I met someone who had actually done something unspeakable. And you cannot make I did the best I could true, no matter what kind of therapy you have. Because he clearly hadn't. So now the test is, what's the positive belief if that person who is distressed for their own culpability deserves therapy, deserves to feel better, what's the positive cognition that might be believable? Yeah? What's the statement I can say about myself in the light of having... Yeah?
I'm still fascinated when it's on the bed.
Well done. You must have a therapist for a mother. Oops. Good people can do bad things. That means you're human. And there is an absolutely lovely protocol developed by Brett Litz in 2009 called Moral Injury and Moral Repair, which was developed specifically in relation to war and combat veterans. We're talking about those people who have perpetrated, failed to prevent, bore witness to, or learned about acts of transgression. So things that transgressed deeply held moral beliefs and expectations. There's a lot to this model, and again, I'm oversimplifying, but I just want to focus on the empty chair component. Chair work in a variety of applications, but essentially you get some chairs out and you get someone to imagine that there's someone in that chair and they can talk to them, or they can hop around and they can take roles on and they can pretend to be other people. In this situation, the individuals are asked to place a figure of caring and benevolent moral authority in a chair. I'm just going to read, basically, this is a copy and paste from the protocol. The goal is to have patients verbalise what they did or saw, how it's affected them, and what they think should happen to them or others over the course of their life as a result, to someone who does not want them to suffer excessively and who feels that forgiveness and reparation is possible. In the first phase, the goal is to get the patient to disclose the transgression, articulate their attributions and how they've been feeling about themselves since the experience, and what they think should happen to them as a result. To enhance engagement with the intensity of the exchange, patients are encouraged to share their remorse and sorrow and what they would like to do to make amends if they could. After the patient sits with the emotion arising from this exercise, the therapist asked him or her to verbalise what the moral authority figure would say to him or her after hearing all this. If necessary, the therapist is instructed to induce content that is forgiveness and reparation related. During preparation and education, the therapist introduces the idea that in order to repair moral injury, the service member or veteran needs to find decency and goodness and ways of doing good deeds as a vehicle for self-forgiveness and repair. In simple terms, this is couched as making amends. To amend something means literally to change. Making amends means drawing a line between the past and the present and in some way changing one's approach to how he or she behaves and acts so that one moves towards the positive, towards better living. Now, who can tell me what concept we have here? Beginning with the letter R, that sounds a bit like that. Reconciliation, but repentance as well. James 4 verse 8 says, "Come near to God and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded." 1 John 1 verse 9 says, "If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just and will forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness." Doesn't that moral injury protocol sound a lot like what prayer should be for us? Confessing what we've done? Telling God, either in the chair, in our mind, in our hearts, in the sky? What we feel about ourselves as a result, and what we think should happen to us for the rest of our lives, what the consequences should be. An expression of real remorse, reparation and forgiveness, drawing a line and moving on towards better living. What a great way to both see ourselves and to understand God and his relationship with us. As someone who doesn't want us to suffer excessively and to feel that forgiveness and reparation is possible, I think we sometimes forget that God actually looks kindly on us, especially when we've fallen short. It's such a deeply moving and powerful experience to be involved in, and I've done it once with a combat veteran, and it was incredible. To cut a long story short, he expressed something he'd done to his mother, even though she was there. He sobbed his way through telling her how awful he thought he was. And at the end of it, I said, "Oh, what does she say now that she's heard all that?" And he paused and he said, "Actually, she told me I'm being stupid and it's time I let it go." We hopped straight into standard EMDR, processed that memory completely in the next 10 minutes. And it was so lovely because this event, all he could recall was the terrible things that he'd done to her. And that actually wasn't what happened. And it was one of his last memories of time with her. And bits that had been hidden from him included them holding hands, them gazing into each other's eyes and smiling at each other, her thanking him, and they both told each other how much they loved each other. The look on his face when he looked at me with complete bewilderment but untold gratitude that I had given him back these memories, which he didn't know existed, was one of my favourite things. It's the closest thing to a miracle I've witnessed. I didn't do it. I could never have made that up and told him, "Hey, I think you were actually way better than you thought you were." And that's not what happens every time. Yeah, different for every situation. My work teaches me the depth of human suffering and misery and the capacity for our brains to heal themselves when given the right direction. The inherent goodness of people created in a perfect image and likeness of a loving God. It gives me a great deal of pride to be involved in doing a small part to bring people a little closer to being the people they were created to be. Thank you.